Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Shelley Burgess, and I am with the FDA's Office of Public Affairs. Thank you for joining us. This is a press briefing for credentialed media to hear more about an important announcement on the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA. Our speakers today are FDA Commissioner Dr. Margaret A. Hamburg and FDA Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine, Michael Taylor. We will begin the briefing with remarks from our speakers, and then we will open it up for Q&A. Also joining us from the agency's Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition are Don Kramer and Jenny Scott, Senior Advisors in the Office of Food Safety, Dr. James Gorney, Senior Advisor for Produce Safety, and Dr. Samir Assar, Director of the Office of Produce Safety. These individuals are here to answer technical questions during the Q&A segment of today's briefing. Commissioner Hamburg will now begin. Commissioner?
Well, thank you. Good morning and Happy New Year. We think that we're off to an auspicious start. I'm very pleased to share an important announcement today that will help protect American families for years to come. We're proposing two of the new food safety rules that will help prevent the foodborne illnesses that affect one in six Americans every year. These proposed rules are a major step forward in implementing the landmark bipartisan FDA Food Safety Modernization Act and represent significant advances towards the administration's goal of strengthening our food safety system to better protect the public health. We have one of the safest food supplies in the world, but we have work to do to stop foodborne illnesses before they start. As a doctor, a public health policymaker, and as a mother, I feel strongly that the concept of prevention is central to making our food supply even safer. While FDA responds very quickly and effectively in response to outbreaks, containing them and finding their source and taking other necessary action, we really need to do more than react after the fact. Preventing problems before they cause harm is not only common sense, it is the key to food safety in the 21st century. The health of our families is too important not to take the necessary steps we're announcing today. Prevention of foodborne illness is the cornerstone of the Food Safety Modernization Act and a major priority for FDA. Foodborne illnesses have taken too great a toll on American consumers every year, killing some 3,000 people and putting almost 130,000 in the hospital, according to the latest CDC data. Of course, these data do not adequately capture the pain and loss that victims of foodborne illness and their families experience. The data also do not adequately capture the loss of confidence that can steer consumers away from healthy foods like fresh fruits and vegetables and the economic losses for food producers. The two proposed rules FDA is releasing today will help us move forward on this important shift taking place already in our country around food safety, a shift from react and respond to prevent. The proposed produce safety rule, which will apply to both domestic and imported fruits and vegetables, will require farms that grow, harvest, pack, or hold certain produce to follow certain standards aimed at preventing contamination of their produce. The proposed rule on preventive controls for human food will require food facilities that manufacture, process, pack, or store certain foods to have a written plan in place to identify potential hazards, put in place steps to address them, verify that the steps are working, and outline how to correct any problems that may arise. These two rules are part of an ongoing reform effort to implement the law passed by Congress. Other rules to be released later will strengthen this effort, include new responsibilities for importers to verify that food products grown or processed overseas are safe, and a system for strengthened audits. Also, an additional proposed rule will address preventive controls for animal feed and pet food production. These will lay the foundation for a modern, prevention-oriented food safety system that will better serve both consumers and the food industry. The FSMA strategy recognizes that the food industry has a responsibility and capacity to produce safe food, but we will all have important roles to play. The law passed by Congress calls for a new definition of a modern framework for regulatory oversight, integration of government food safety efforts, and public-private collaboration. The rules build on voluntary industry guidelines for food safety that many producers and growers now follow, so that we are hopefully well on our way to reducing the burden of compliance and speeding successful implementation because of this familiarity with accepted best practices. FSMA also provides the FDA with new inspection and enforcement tools to ensure that companies are carrying out their responsibilities and to keep contaminated products from entering the marketplace. So how did we get here? The critical public health and economic impacts of foodborne illnesses are what brought the food industry, consumers, and congressional leaders together to enact FSMA. This convergence was based not only on a common understanding of the food safety problem, but also on a remarkable consensus on the solution, a solution born out of the food industry's experience in grappling with safety challenges in today's complex global food system and the experience of public health. We know that pathogens can enter the food supply at any stage along the pathway from the farm through the growing and harvesting stages in processing, transport, storage, and retail sale. We also know that reasonable, science-based steps can be taken at each stage to prevent and minimize the presence and growth of pathogens and thus reduce the risk of illness. The solution to the problem of foodborne illness is a comprehensive prevention strategy that involves all participants in the food system, domestic and foreign, doing their part to minimize the likelihood of harmful contamination. And that is the cornerstone of FSMA and embodied in the first two proposed rules. No strategy can achieve a zero-risk food supply, but our strategy is grounded in the conviction that we can better protect consumers and the economic vigor of the food system if everyone involved implements reasonably available and scientifically sound measures to reduce risk. The development of these rules has been truly a collaborative effort with extensive outreach to consumers, other federal agencies, government at many levels, including our international partners, industry, public health and agricultural science experts, and many, many others. The FDA conducted a series of some 14 farm tours around the country, visited several food and feed facilities, large and small, delivered more than 350 presentations, engaged in many, many meetings, well over 500, five formal federal public meetings, and more. So we really engaged in extensive outreach as we prepared these proposed rules and are looking forward to the comment period in response to this publication. And at this time, I'd like to turn things over to FDA's Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine, Michael Taylor, who will share some of the more salient points of the rules today and in the future. And as many of you know, Mike has devoted himself to this food safety effort over the past several years, and I really want to take this opportunity to thank him and his dedicated team who have worked so hard to help make FSMA a reality and now to implement it. Mike?
Thank you, Commissioner Hamburg, and thank you as well for your leadership and support on our food safety initiatives, which really has been critical. And I do have to echo the acknowledgement and appreciation of just the extraordinary professional staff at FDA who worked long and hard to get these rules where they are. We're deeply grateful for that. And as you said, these rules really are a very big step in the direction of creating a comprehensive prevention-based food safety system that really uses the best available science to reduce the risk of illness. And so this is a landmark occasion for our food safety program. I will take just a few minutes to briefly summarize the two proposed rules that we're putting out today and also put them in some context of our other FSMA implementation efforts and some things that are coming in our continued implementation. Let me focus first on the produce safety rule, which is based on the central mandate of the Food Safety Modernization Act to establish standards to prevent the introduction of reasonably foreseeable hazards that can make people sick. And our rules focus specifically on microbiological hazards, bacteria, E. coli, salmonella, listeria, and so forth, that have been associated with illnesses related to produce. And the regulation focuses on four major pathways for possible contamination of fresh fruits and vegetables with such pathogens. And these pathways that are addressed in the regulation include water, so we're concerned about the microbial quality of the water and how it's used, worker employee hygiene, so that basic sanitation is observed among those who are handling food. We're focusing on materials that are put into the soil, like manure, composted materials, to be sure those are handled properly. And finally, we're concerned about the animals who might come into growing fields and potentially contribute to contamination. The produce rule also addresses conditions in packing houses, where we know from experience that product that may have grown safely in the field can possibly be contaminated or spread contamination. So our proposed rule will address criteria for growers to follow in each of these five major areas. We've said all along that we do not want a regulation that is one size fits all. That will never work across the diversity of the agricultural system, the produce sector of the ag system. And so as you look into the rules, you'll see many ways in which we have carefully tailored the regulatory requirements to target those commodities and those practices where standards can actually make a practical difference for food safety. Just to give you an example, in the case of irrigation water, it matters whether the water is applied directly to the crop or not. If it's applied directly to the edible portion of the food, say the tomato on the vine, then it must be subject to a certain microbial quality standard. If it's used in drip irrigation and never touches the crop, then it is not necessarily subject to that sort of standard. Many ways in which we've tailored these rules and to be very practical and apply to different risk situations. Just another broad example, we really are targeting essentially fresh fruits and vegetables. So products that are normally go to a canning operation, for example, would not be subject to the rule. Likewise, crops like potatoes and artichokes that are traditionally cooked before preparation would not be subject to these rules because there's the microbial hazard is handled through that processing. So again, there's a lot of more to discuss and look forward to your questions on that, but that's briefly a summary of the produce rule. The preventive controls rule for human food facilities establishes the basic framework for controlling hazards during processing. And the preventive controls rule is mandated by the Food Safety Modernization Act. It's really grounded in principles that the food industry has developed over the last few decades, known by some as HACCP, H-A-C-C-P, for Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Points. This is an approach to food safety that is already mandated by FDA for seafood and juice, by USDA for meat and poultry. What Congress has said and what we're doing with this rule is applying those basic established principles of preventive controls to all food processing settings. And what it basically means, again, it's a very adaptable, very flexible system. It says that in each individual facility, the operator simply must identify the potential hazards, identify the controls that can work to mitigate, to reduce those hazards, implement those controls on a continuing basis, document, keep records, and then make corrections when needed when deviations occur. So again, it's basic common sense preventive process control for food safety. And again, it will ensure that there's a common set of standards across the food system so that all commodities are subject to the same basic approach to food safety. These two regulations, as the Commissioner indicated, establish the prevention standards for our new food safety system. They are part, however, of an overall package of regulations that will address, in addition to human food, animal feed and food. So we are expecting soon to issue a proposed preventive control rule for animal feed and food facilities. But there are also regulations coming that address how we verify that the standards are actually being met, especially with respect to imported food. So again, as the Commissioner mentioned, Congress has mandated that we establish a foreign supplier verification program, which requires importers, those who are bringing food into the United States, to verify that the food has been produced under the same kind of modern preventive systems that we're requiring for domestic producers and processors, and verify that that actually has happened for the food that's coming into the United States. This will give us FDA a much stronger basis, a much stronger framework for overseeing the safety of imports. So we're shifting from, again, FDA examining product at the port of entry and reacting to problems, being able to verify that importers have prevented problems. And so that's an integral part of the system. We expect that to be coming forward shortly, along with, finally, the rule that the commissioner mentioned that will strengthen private audits to create an accredited third-party certification program, which we think can, again, leverage private resources, but in a way that's reliable for public purposes in verifying compliance with standards. Coming back to the rules that we're proposing today, I just want to make a final couple of points about how we've approached this rulemaking. And one thing that has been central to our consideration is how to be sure these rules can work for all businesses, small and large. So there's a considerable attention paid in the regulations to the concerns of small businesses, trying to make the rules as flexible as possible. We're proposing certain exemptions for very small businesses. We're allowing additional compliance time. We're proposing to allow additional compliance time for small and very small firms, so to give them plenty of time to adjust. And then implementation assistance will be a focal point. We'll focus that on small businesses. And I think looking both at the produce and preventive controls rules, we realize that we need to collaborate with the industry, you know, with the state governments, with the Department of Agriculture, with Extension Services, to provide technical assistance and support to small growers and processors to implement these rules. And we've established various mechanisms to do that, and I think that'll be an important part of our implementation. As the commissioner said, we have done extensive outreach that has really contributed enormously to what's in these proposed rules. We've learned a lot from our stakeholders, but as the commissioner said, we are eager for the next round of comment. We expect a good, robust dialogue with our stakeholders to get to final rules that, again, meet the test of being applicable across the diversity of the food system, that are practical and effective across that diversity. So I will close with that and turn it back over to Shelley and look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Hamburg and Mr. Taylor. At this time, we will proceed to the Q&A segment. Before you ask a question, please introduce yourself and identify your affiliation. Please also limit your time to one question and one follow-up so we can get to as many questions as possible. Operator, we can begin now.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. Once again, to ask a question on the phone line, please press star, then one. One moment, please, for our first question. Our first question comes from Mary Claire Jeronic with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi. So how much would this entire package cost, this package introduced today, and how soon could everything be implemented? I know that, or be finalized, I guess. How soon could these rules be finalized? I know you guys had some detail about it could be 26 months for some larger farms, but I wasn't sure on the other rule what that schedule was. How soon could we see these be actually in effect?
Well, this is Dr. Hamburg, and I'll let Mike follow up. But I mean, your question is very broad, and it's difficult to answer in terms of overall cost because they'll both be initial costs to implement, but there'll also be savings overall to the system and new efficiencies and, of course, prevention of problems that otherwise would have taken a toll both in health and on industry and healthcare. So that is really a very hard question to respond to. But in terms of the implementation, this is a partnership, and there will be a requirement for FDA to implement new programs and policies and activities. There will also be an expectation on industry to step up to the plate and make important changes and implement programs. Many companies, of course, are already involved in those activities, and others will be strengthening their programs. Of course, we'll be working with state governments and with international partners as well as we implement it. So it has many moving parts, and I think that we recognize that different pieces will occur at different times and require different levels of investment. There are some components that will be implemented very swiftly after the final rules go into place. Others, especially for the small farms, as you noted, will be much more staged. So it's a complex picture in terms of both implementation and how to assess costs.
Well, do you guys have any sort of estimates, though? I mean, first of all, I guess the cost I'm asking about is the implementation cost, and in terms of the timeline, just, you know, to tell readers when's the soonest that this could actually be finalized and then actually in place.
Clarify, sort of Mary Claire, are you referring to cost to the government or cost to the industry?
Cost to the government.
You know, we've said from the beginning that we do require additional resources to fully implement the law. We can issue the regulations, but the ongoing implementation will require strengthening of the breadth of our technical expertise, strengthening our partnership and the capacity of state governments, strengthening our import oversight system substantially. The President's budget for 2013 included a request for $220 million in additional resources for FSMA implementation that would have been covered by fees. And resources in that range certainly are, you know, go a long way towards meeting our needs. But the funding is an issue that we'll continue to address, you know, with the administration and Congress as we go forward.
It's obviously very important to the success of this effort to make sure that we have adequate resources, and it's something I can tell you that Mike Taylor is putting a huge amount of focus on. We are excited by the interest in really full partnership, and industry recognizes their critical role in their accountability in making many of these important changes, and the states clearly are a critical partner and are eager to work with us. And we also hope that we'll be able to work very closely with Congress as we shape the 2013 budget and the 2014 budget, recognizing the importance of implementing this and the critical savings that can be achieved both in terms of improved health and improved health of this important industry.
Just briefly on the time frame for completion, the rulemaking, you know, that we're beginning now will involve a 120-day comment period, and then we will need time to evaluate those comments, devise a final rule, and prepare a document that responds to the comments. So that process normally, you know, can take up to a year of work for FDA. And then we would hope to go forward, you know, soon thereafter with final rules. And then there is, as you know, a phased-in implementation period. So I think it's important for people to understand that we are building a new system. It will happen over time. You know, the private sector continues to move in this direction in parallel. And so I think, you know, we're both making progress as we go and also establishing a system for the long-term future that will be more effective and efficient.
Operator, we'll take the next question.
Next question comes from Bill Thompson with Dow Jones. Your line is open.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks. One of the provisions in here talks about animal intrusion into fields. And I'm not talking about the grazing animals, but it's as if under the circumstances, there's a reasonable probability that there will be animal intrusion. I mean, how do farmers keep, you know, wild animals from spreading bacteria onto crops? I mean, what can be done to do that?
Well, this is a good example of where we've taken what we think is a very practical approach to protecting the safety of food, and realizing that food is grown outdoors. There's no way we can confine produce fields and insulate them from deer and other wildlife that will come through. And so what the practical expectation is, and our proposed rule is, that farmers will be observant and they will be aware of intrusion, and they will not harvest and take, you know, measures to be sure that the product that has been contaminated, that has been, you know, potentially contaminated by animals, is not harvested. So it's realistic about the, you know, open environment in which crops are grown, but taking seriously that if farmers aren't observant and don't protect the crop, you know, that's been contaminated from entering into the food supply, people can get sick.
Thanks.
Operator, we'll take the next question.
Next question comes from Dan Charles with National Public Radio. Your line is open.
Quick question on the distinction with the small farms. I looked at it very briefly, and it looked like there's what was called a qualified exemption for the small farms that meet the criteria of the, you know, the tester amendment. Does that simply mean they're exempt unless you have some reason to think that there's a problem and then you would go in, or is there, would they be subject to some of these regulations, even in absence of any, you know, sort of evidence of a problem?
Well, we hope and expect that all farms, regardless of size, will be paying close attention to appropriate food safety practices. But the law did include an amendment to essentially exempt farms of a certain size, small farms, and when problems would arise, we would of course engage, but they would not be covered by the specifics of these rules.
But and again, these are farms that are of a small size, as the Commissioner indicated, and who are selling most of, at least half or more of their crops directly to consumers or retail establishments in a sort of a local situation. The law does permit us in a circumstance in which such a farm that is not initially covered has been associated with a food safety problem, we can revoke the exemption and bring them into the system. So, but that's the statutory construct that Congress established in this area.
Operator, we will take the next question.
Next question comes from Tom Karst with the Packer newspaper. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. How hard was it to calculate the benefits and costs to the proposed, the produce safety rule? And was that one of the reasons why the delay in publishing this proposed rule?
Well, I'll comment first and Mike can elaborate, but it was a challenge in terms of, you know, sort of how do you decide which variables you're going to focus in their sort of concentric circles of potential cost and benefit and impact. And, you know, we're really talking about a strategy that focuses on preventing problems, which is harder to measure in some ways than assessing burden. But this was one of the areas where we worked very closely with all stakeholders in terms of collecting data that would be meaningful for analysis and understanding the different types of impacts. And, you know, we do have an expert team of economists here and have the opportunity to work with the White House Office, OIRA, the Office of Regulatory Affairs, and their economists. And, you know, I think that it's an important component of putting together this set of proposed rules.
Yeah, I mean, and I think if you ask the economists, there's one word to answer your question. Yes, it's hard. And I think, you know, encourage you to read the documents. And as the Commissioner said, it's very difficult to, you know, to quantitatively project the future given the multifactorial nature of the causation of most illnesses. But, you know, one thing we're very clear about, and if you read the documents, I mean, we're very confident that, you know, the benefits of these rules will substantially outweigh the costs, even if you look just at estimated reductions in illness, but if you also take into account avoiding disruption of the food supply and the particular commodities that are affected by an outbreak, there have been devastating impacts on the markets for, you know, key commodities and loss of confidence, you know, in those commodities by consumers. And so I think when you look at the benefits overall, you know, I think we'll see that the benefits really substantially outweigh the cost of implementation.
And it's striking to note that industry and consumers have been equally enthusiastic about seeing these proposed rules published and the opportunity to really move to the next stage of implementing the preventive framework of the Food Safety Modernization Act.
Operator, we'll take the next question.
Next question comes from Joe Sanitrin from Huffington Post. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks so much. Could you talk a little bit about what the FDA is going to do to ensure that farms are actually complying with these regulations?
Yeah, be a number of things that we'll be doing, you know, beginning with collaborating with the produce industry and with state agriculture departments and USDA Extension Service to educate farmers on the new requirements and to provide technical assistance in the form of training and you know, various tools that will help farmers comply. We've we've created a partnership, a produce safety alliance that involves those parties I mentioned, the Department of Agriculture here, state agriculture departments. It's based at Cornell University, which has been a center for educating growers on good agricultural practices. And that alliance is specifically engaged in developing training materials and doing outreach to small growers. So it begins with education, outreach, technical assistance in collaboration with the agricultural sector. And then as Congress directs, we will partner with state agencies in providing ongoing oversight. You know, FDA may do some inspections, but we have limited resources to inspect produce operations, and we have a clear direction from Congress to collaborate with state agencies. So we expect, you know, much of the oversight to come at the state and local level. And then, again, it's important to understand that by establishing for the first time national standards for safe growing practices, the private sector, which is over the last decade been a real source of driving standards and accountability for produce safety, they will then have a national set of agreed upon standards to apply in conducting their own audits and oversight of their suppliers. So it'll come from, you know, the assurance, the verification that the standards are being met will come from multiple sources, and not just from the traditional FDA inspect and enforce model.
Yeah, I just want to underscore what Mike said, and, you know, really the great opportunity here is to put in place a common framework that's science-based and driven by known risk, and it enables industry, I think, farms big and small to be able to organize themselves around one set of principles and standards. Right now, farms are being asked to adhere to certain standards, but if they are selling to one company, it might be one set of standards, to another company, another set of standards, and that's very challenging for them. Now there's going to be, you know, a uniform, agreed-upon approach that I think will both be driven by the best possible science and be agreed upon and enforced at various levels, both local and state, as well as industry, and of course the FDA will play a critical role.
I mean, just to return to the state oversight question for a second, I mean, is the FDA going to have a budget to contract those inspections on a state level, or, you know, how are you going to make sure that the states have the resources to do that?
Well, part of the mandate of the Food Safety Modernization Act was really to move towards a much more integrated food safety system, bringing in the states as real partners with the FDA going forward, as well as, of course, USDA. But the State Departments of Agriculture are part of our vision for implementation, and we have been engaged in providing some resources to states as they move forward to strengthen their programs working with farms and food producers, and we hope that will continue to expand and be strengthened. And we see an opportunity both through our ability to work directly with state departments of agriculture and state departments of public health, but also through these public-private partnerships and the alliances that Mike Taylor mentioned earlier, that will provide education, training, and technical assistance.
Got it. Thanks.
Operator, we will take the next question.
Next question comes from Ellen Ferguson with Congressional Quarterly. Your line is open.
Thank you. Is the administration going to renew its request for for facility registration fees for the remainder of 2013, or will the administration renew the request in its budget request for fiscal 2014?
Well, the 2014 budget, of course, being shaped as we speak, the user fee request was in the president's proposed 2013 budget, as Mike Taylor mentioned earlier, and of course we will be involved in continuing discussions around both of those budgets as time goes forward.
Well, I asked that question because Mr. Taylor, in March of last year, indicated that without additional funding, it would be very difficult to make the rules once they were issued and took effect to actually carry out the mandate under the food safety law. So if there is no request for, if the administration is not going to press for this, where is this additional money going to come from?
Well, we're going to continue to work on the issue of user fees, and we certainly have been engaged in discussions with our critical stakeholders on that issue. We also, you know, do believe that there needs to be a commitment in terms of budget authority to support these critical programs as well. And so we are expecting to see in the 2013 budget discussion about this important set of questions. And then, as I mentioned, the 2014 budget is currently being shaped, so I can't really address specifics in that at this time. But resources remain an ongoing concern.
Operator, we'll take the next question, please.
Our next question comes from Rochelle Aragon with Gourmet News. Your line is open.
No, I don't have a question. Thank you.
Thank you. Operator, we will take the next question.
Next question comes from Rick Viros with Food Health Tech. Your line is open.
Tech. Thank you very much. This question is kind of geared more, I think, towards Mike Taylor. And, Mike, I wanted to kind of focus on the prevention or preventative controls rule. It appears that we've got now HACCP for everyone. And based on what you said about the 120-day comment period, and it might take up to about a year for the final rule and then time to comply, is HACCP now going to be the basis of FDA inspections of food processing facilities across the board? And two, is there any either limit to size of a company, or does it go all the way down to a very, very tiny company of 2-3 employees?
Well, to your first question, yes. I mean, the HACCP-based preventive controls, HACCP-type preventive controls, really grounded in HACCP principles, you know, will be the framework for all the food commodities and products that we regulate. That's the central mandate of the Food Safety Modernization Act for food facilities. With respect to how, you know, whether it would apply to absolutely every facility, again, you're aware probably of the amendment we discussed earlier, the so-called Tester Amendment, that exempted certain small operators selling direct to consumers. The law also directs us to define very small business for purposes of this qualified facility designation that arises under the Tester Amendment, and so we've teed up some options for exempting firms that would not otherwise be exempted by Tester based upon their sales, still be very small firms, but we're inviting comment basically on whether there should be, you know, some additional exemptions for very small firms beyond what's allowed by Tester. So it remains to be seen how absolutely universal, but it's not absolutely universal because, again, already Congress has exempted certain facilities, and we're considering exempting some additional very small facilities.
Okay. And not every component of a hazard prevention plan will apply to every facility. You know, the plans will be tailored to the specifics of the commodity that's being produced there, and so, you know, different plans will be more comprehensive than others, and it's all designed around reducing risk and vulnerability for microbial contamination and bringing to bear experience and science on how to reduce risk.
Dr. Hamburg, I mean, there's HACCP plans that are out there that are not necessarily very detailed. So how does FDA guide industry with, you know, as you put it, the one size doesn't fit all?
Yeah. Well, I do think, you know, one of the things that we are committing to as we move forward is really a very active, ongoing, and dynamic process that will involve putting forward a lot of guidances mm-hmm. to help address specific concerns around specific commodities and types of approaches. Also recognizing that we are at a moment in time when science is going to provide a lot of new tools and answers to how to manage some of these contamination risks. And so there will need to be a continual updating of our approaches. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that is a real opportunity here is to really organize around a common and uniform preventive approach that really is grounded in science and risk reduction, so that you don't have a lot of preventive control programs out there addressing the same processes, the same commodities, but that are different and can, you know, a little bit confusing or contradictory. And, you know, really trying to make sure. I mean, we've worked very hard to try to make these proposed rules as, you know, flexible and adaptable, but appropriate as possible, and not to do a lot of things simply because they might be done, but to do the things that will really matter to protect the health of the public.
Thank you.
Okay, operator, we have time for one last question.
Next question comes from Rebecca Volker with JAMA Medical News. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I want to make sure I heard something correctly that Mr. Taylor said earlier, that if foods that are cooked before preparation are not subject to the rule, is that right?
In the produce rule, foods like potatoes and artichokes that are normally cooked before consumption, yes, we don't cover in the rule.
Okay, but in that case, you can't really guarantee that people are going to cook them to the proper temperature, and, you know, perhaps they may be eaten raw on occasion, too. So I'm just kind of wondering whether that's
right.
Sufficient.
Yeah, so again, I think in you know, we're directed by Congress to establish risk-based standards that are practical. And based upon what we know about, you know, our experience from foodborne illness outbreaks and other evidence, you know, we think this approach is, you know, targets what really will be significant from a public health standpoint. If we get evidence to the contrary during the rulemaking, all of this is absolutely subject to being revisited. But, you know, again, our charge was to craft a set of rules that would reflect what we know from the science and the risk, our understanding of risk. And we think, as our proposal, we think we're in the right place to start this dialogue, so we welcome a comment on that.
Okay, and I'm curious, too, is there any estimate of how many foodborne illnesses might be prevented as these rules are carried out?
again, this is where it's extraordinarily difficult, given the you know, all of the factors that go into causing a particular illness, to sort of associate particular numbers of illnesses reduced by virtue of this or that intervention. But, you know, we have estimated, we have taken approaches to estimating reductions in illnesses that yield, you know, significant benefits, significant reduction. We estimate as many as 1.25 million illnesses, you know, prevented. Again, there's a lot of complexity in those analyses. Those are estimates, but we see opportunities for significant reduction in foodborne illness from this rule.
Okay. You know, and you can just look at a couple of the recent outbreaks that, you know, were quite serious in terms of burden of illness, and they occurred because of problems that would have been addressed by these kinds of approaches. So I think, you know, we're very optimistic that we will begin to see real change. Now, I also want to caution that by saying that as we also enhance our scientific tools for disease surveillance, some of the trends may be a little bit hard to track, because we are increasingly good at identifying foodborne outbreaks, even as we're putting in place new strategies to prevent them. So we can't really fully assess this just by a sheer numbers of outbreaks kind of a calculation. We have to have ongoing monitoring that will go the next level deeper and look at the types of outbreaks and how they are caused and what are the strategies to prevent them and reduce risk.
Okay, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's media briefing.